Okay, so we'll try again. So we'll start. We're going to continue to talk about neutron interferometry. In fact, we'll do that for a few days. I thought to finish it up this week. But I don't want to introduce the Krauss decomposition from a superoperator and the Wigner function in one class. I think that it's too many ideas for an hour. So we'll talk about the Wigner function tomorrow. We'll get through all the Krauss stuff today. And then that will leave spins for next week, okay? But you know, I'd rather go over things in detail than cover more and more modalities. So at the end, we drop something, or once we have all the physics, we can cover some of these modalities pretty quickly. Okay, so at the recitation then yesterday, you went over the superoperator description again, and just to remind you that we have a superoperator that we're going to construct in this way. Where we have a distribution of unitaries acting upon a system, and that distribution is governed by some classical probability distribution. And Chris asked a great question after class yesterday, that of why I write these in terms of polys. That, so to remind you that P sub I are the elements of the poly matrices. And the poly matrices are, of course, a complete basis, and they're a convenient one. As an experimentalist, we like these because we want to take the dynamics back to a Hamiltonian picture. And so when I'm thinking about the dynamics, then I'm imagining that I have some system that's governed by some processes. There'll be a multiple of these operating on the Hilbert space. And you remember that over SU2, this is a generic way of writing a unitary where n just points to a direction in space, right? And of course, the correspondence to SO3 follows then immediately, right? So that I hope you've seen. Now, however, if you look in the literature and you look at the wikis for Wikipedia or others for these things, instead of finding the poly matrices, you'll find the superoperator defined in the transition basis. And so instead of having the polys, we'll have another set of operators there. And these operators will be the transition basis. And of course, they're a complete set of operators too. And we will have to make use of this later on. And of course, there's a correspondence that we would rewrite these in terms of polys as those idempotents, or two of them are idempotents. Yeah? So there's a transition, there's the poly basis and the so-called transition basis. And we'll go between those. But it makes no difference as you're looking at the literature which of these you're looking at. There's a similarity transform that takes you between those. So as long as there's a similarity transform, at some fundamental level, nothing interesting is happening. Of course, to get insight into the picture, there may be something interesting happening. One basis may give us more insight than the other. Okay, now I want to go over quickly the last piece that we looked at yesterday. we had our neutron interferometer. We put a prism here. And remember that this prism is actually out of the board. I just don't know how to draw it that way. Okay, so the prism is acting in the z direction, and so that for our neutron interferometer, we saw that the first blade is a y rotation of pi over 2, that we can combine these two blades to be a minus pi over 2 rotation about y. And now this piece here is going to be a rotation about the z-axis because it's a phase shift and it's acting on only on one path. But the angle depends upon this wave vector in the spatial coordinate. So we have now a wave number. And the wave number is telling us the pitch of the prism. And we have a spatial coordinate. Which is telling us the height of the neutron beam in the interferometer, right? And so the fact that these are both z's is just accidental. Yeah? One is talking about the unitary dynamics, one is talking about the height of the beam in the interferometer. And then we created a super operator for this. And now at this point, last time I skipped a few steps. At this point, I'm going to go over them, because I want to make sure that you've got this picture. And so what we'll do is we'll describe a super operator just for that prism. Okay? And then we can act on that super operator by these unitaries. Okay? So now we have a super operator just for the prism. And therefore, I want to integrate over this probability distribution. So I need to define the distribution. Here's the Hamiltonian, effectively. And don't write that down. Because that's an angle. It's a little bit drag to write down the Hamiltonian where I have an angle in the Hamiltonian. But fine, we'll write it as a propagator, right? So u of z is equal to e to the I, there's no reason for a minus sign, qz sigma z divided by 2. Yeah, and so now we have a proper propagator. And we'll indicate that it's the propagator of the prism. And we're going to integrate it over that. So let's define that minus 0.5 to plus 0.5. Is a range of z, just to have some normalized piece. And then the probability, p of z, remember that we needed a probability as we sum, in this case, integrate over these actions. We'll just take that to be 1, since we're integrating over 0 to, over, you know, 0, minus 0.5 to 0.5. And I want the area to be 1, so we'll just take it to be 1. And so life is easy. And now we have an integral. And let me indicate that that's the ijth component of this again. And I'll take p sub I u of z for the prism. P sub j, u prism z to the inverse. We'll integrate over that. Yeah?
Stupid question. Why is there 1/2 in the exponent of the propagator?
Because the trace of the identity is 2. So
okay.
Just take a Taylor series expansion. And to get the right action, you need to normalize that by half.
Okay.
What is P of Z 1?
Oh, I just dropped it out because it's 1. Was that your question?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, it's 1, so it's in there, but it's 1.
I was asking, why is exactly PLZ 1?
Oh, because I'm integrating from, it's 0 outside of this range.
Right.
So, okay. So it's 1 over that range.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Some constant between.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So then we can write down S fully and S sine Q over 2 divided by Q. It's a sinc function, 0, 0. Looks like that, not surprising. And we see that all we do is have an attenuation of this. And now the attenuation is of sigma x and sigma y, because we're talking about the prism, and the prism is a z rotation. Now, of course, if I map this onto the total interferometer, then I would rotate that by these y rotations, and it would look like a sigma x operation over the interferometer. Okay? Good. But now, the reason that we're looking at it as just the prism is, you'll remember that we then looked at moving the prism to the other blade. Okay, so as I move the prism to the other blade, and I'm going to have Q prime, but the analysis is going to be exactly the same, except that U of this, so let's call it the prism in the down beam, as a function of Z is going to pick up a negative sign. Right, so we'll have a term that goes as e to the minus I q prime z sigma z over 2. Yeah? And the you'll remember that, well, that's enough. That's pretty obvious, right? This is acting on the zero state, this is acting on the one state, we pick up a change in sign. When I integrate this, of course, I don't pick up a change in sign, right? That the super operator is still attenuative, and the sinc function is an even function, so nothing changes, except that I'm going to replace Q by Q prime. So the super operator now for the prism in the down state is exactly the super operator for the prism, okay, as long as Q is the same. Right, if I choose a different Q, then it's a different value. Is that clear? Have I made it too complicated? No, it's clear? Perfect. All right. So then we do the obvious of putting two prisms in. Now, of course, if the prisms were acting unitarily, then I would simply multiply the actions together. That here, I have some phase, e to the I qz. Here I have 0, 1, 0, right? Here I have some phase, e to the I q prime, 1, 0, 0, e to the I q prime z. Right? And I would just multiply them together. And I would see that I would get a global phase out of this whole process. It's tempting to multiply the superoperators together, but if I multiply the superoperators together, I would get an attenuation that went to sinc squared, right? So it would look like I would lose attenuation faster than we actually do. And the point is, it's just an old story told in any probability class, that if you have a distribution, if you take the sum of the averages, it's not equal to the average of the sum, right? And that's all that we're saying here. But it's an important message to remember that the superoperator is a really convenient picture to tell us the overall action for a distribution. But by calculating the superoperator, we've suppressed the distribution. We've integrated over that distribution. And so when you want to explore new physics, you need to go back and keep the distribution in mind and recalculate the superoperators. Okay. Yes, please.
Do we have the same for mimetric tests for photometrics if we change it to the missing side? Instead of using the poly, we use the transition.
It's the action, the description of the superoperators, you apply it, it's the same. But of course, it looks different. I'm going to come to that in just a few minutes. Okay, it is related just by a similarity transform. And it's easy enough to write out that similarity transform. We will do it because that similarity transform is given right there. Yeah?
Is it safe though to always be able to combine a superoperator with a unitary on either side?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Right, because the unitary is going to, because quantum mechanics is linear, so the unitary, if I think about it acting over a distribution, we could always bring it inside. Yeah?
And I'm a little lost in one respect on the construction here of the superoperators.
Sure.
Somehow enclosed that it's trace preserving in that with us?
I hope so.
Okay.
You might check. And I'm glad you asked. There may be a factor of half that I should have included in there. And certainly in the notes that I hand out, that factor of half is correct if it's there. So we can go back and check on that. But the superoperator, the superoperator is completely positive. If we have a unitary process and the superoperator preserves the purity of the system. If we have a general completely positive, then the superoperator preserves the trace because it always returns the valid density matrix. Yeah?
Okay, I was just wondering about that. So we can't use this to represent like the process of measuring, throwing out the result, and starting with the new SLF that principle.
The superoperator, we can use it to describe non-CP dynamics, and we can use it to change the size of Hilbert space. So we can describe a P of EM, which those of you that took Daniel's course heard about. The decomposition that we're going to go through next, from the superoperator into a set of Krauss operators, would not work then. So that is only going to be true for completely positive maps. And everything we've thought about will be completely positive. The fact that I can write it like this guarantees that. Okay. Good. So that's everything I wanted there. And now what I'd like to do is to add some random noise. So I told you yesterday the story about us building a new interferometer and finding out that the contrast wasn't everything that we wanted, and being disappointed to hear that is the norm in the field. And we will show next week that we can use quantum error correction to avoid that situation. So that's a problem that could have been fixed earlier. But let's describe the physics. Yes, please.
I'm a little confused about how you're using the word superoperator. Originally, I thought you meant just something that maps Hermitian operators to Hermitian operators. But no, it seems like you're talking about, like, if we use a superoperator, then we can't, like, you're talking about Well, you said if we use a super operator, then we can't do this. But if we use a unitary, then we can't do this. Like,
okay, so let me try to clarify this. The super operator construction as a general map of a system is more general than I've described it. Okay, and it can describe any apparent map. And if there's prior correlation, so if our system is correlated with an environment or with some other piece, and we're neglecting those correlations, then it's very easy to have a super operator that, when we measure it, appears not to return a density matrix. Mm-hmm. And it's a challenge in the field today of how we deal with that. There's lots of ways. Now, for most of physics, you know, we assume that we're operating over some simple system, or if there's an environment, the environment is acting in a nice way as a Markov process, and that the system and the environment were separable at the beginning of the process. Under those conditions, the superoperator will be completely positive. And so it's not by construction that the superoperator will always be completely positive, but for much of the physics we'll operate on, it will be completely positive. Other questions? Okay. So now, I have my interferometer again. We'll put a phase flag there. And what happens is there's small imperfections in the blade. And these imperfections can be quite small. Remember that 40 micron imperfections correspond to a pi phase shift. And although it's very easy, although we have the technology to make a piece flat, this is a three-dimensional object. And it's not enough that it be flat. It can't be trapezoidal shape, that you can have both sides flat. And still, if they're not perfectly parallel, we don't want to have a 40 micron variation over a centimeter. And so that technology we haven't sorted out yet. And these things are random imperfections. And so we're going to describe them by some Gaussian distribution of phase angles. And so I could say that I have some probability of having an error. And there's the errors that we're looking at. And these errors correspond to phase shifts. So e to the I epsilon theta z, they correspond to a phase shift of the system. And I'm going to center it at zero, because if there's any DC, any phase shift off zero, I can simply put that into the phase flag. And so anything that would take me away from zero in the distribution, I'll simply put in over here to say that at this point we have a phase flag too. You had a question? Pi. Okay. So if I take this Gaussian distribution, and I'm going to leave it as just this one blade, and I'm going to leave it on the left-hand side of the blade. And the reason is that it will slightly simplify the physics. It'll save me writing a few steps. And I'll ask you, as a homework assignment, to think about what happens if you have the errors on all the blades. Okay, so the homework. We add phase noise. To all the blades. But you can see that this process becomes simple, because now those two operators, the operator describing the phase noise and the operator describing the phase flag commutes with each other, and so I can simply combine them into one operator. And then we've already solved this problem. I can simply integrate over the distribution, but now I have to integrate over this Gaussian distribution. Yeah? And it is easy to integrate over Gaussians. You get a bunch of error functions. Everyone knows an error function, yeah? So a sigmoidal curve. And if you go through that, and let me not write the math on the board, because it's exactly what I wrote up here, except instead of having a flat distribution, we're integrating over the Gaussian. And then let me just show you the result. Now remember that experimentally, Dima measured this curve for the O and H beam of the contrast. So what we have here is the intensity at the helium-3 detectors versus the change in width of a particular phase flag. And we can see that the O beam has this intensity. Remember that the O beam should go from 0 to 1, and that there's two effects here. There's the transmission coefficient. So if we change the transmission reflection coefficient, then it comes down, but should still always reach 0. And the H beam always goes from 1 down. And again, as we change the transmission reflection coefficient, it doesn't reach 0, but it should always reach the full intensity. Okay, and so what we would expect in this case, and the fact that these overlap here is just accidental. There's nothing fundamental about that. And so now we take the simulation, and we have two quantities here. T is the transmission probability, and by pushing it all the way here, the transmission probability is 1/2. Okay, so this is the ideal curve, and R is the width of this Gaussian distribution. So by taking the Gaussian distribution to 0, then I've removed the noise, and we see the full contrast. And as we would expect, if I vary T, then these points don't change. So the O and the H beam. And I'm sorry for changing the colors between these two. But actually, I'm colorblind, so I don't pay attention to colors. And then R, nicely as we add noise, does exactly what we want. It moves things from 0. Okay? And so then we can play with these, and it's not worth playing with very much. To approximately match the curve, you can fit the curve and get it exactly right. And so now we can understand the full physics of what's going on. That in this case, the transmission reflection coefficients are not equal, and there is some phase noise that's taking us away. So if we wanted to improve this, we would have to change the width of the blades to get the transmission reflection coefficients right, and we'd have to change the polishing of the blades to get these things down to 0. Yeah?
Is the data from experiments where there's phase noise for all the blades, or?
That's the only experiments we can do. You sound like a theoretician. Okay. Good. Is there anything else? No. This is all I want to show. Okay. So now I'm going to take this model. And we'll write down the super operator for this. So the super operator, when you look in the notes, these numbers will not be quite 1, But that's just because I have a finite range of integrating the Gaussian probabilities over. It's just tails of the Gaussians. And it just saves me some time in calculating. But, you know, you can get them as close to one as you want, but again, it's an error function, so it doesn't go perfectly. And these are just real numbers that have a complicated error function for analysis, right? But they're just real numbers less than one. So f of r is less than one, and it goes like an error function. So now what I want to do is I want to take this super operator description, and I would like to return from that a compact set of operators to describe the dynamics. And we already know what those are going to be, because we've gone through this just in looking at the physics. You know, it better be that we have a sigma x operator. And there has to be a second operator, but if it's just sigma x, it would be unitary. There's some probability that we do the correct thing. There's some probability that it's the identity. Okay, but let's go through it. So what we're going to do is to take the super operator in the Pauli basis. I want to convert that to the super operator in the transition basis. And as we do that, so remember that the mapping is, we're going to identity plus sigma z over 2, sigma plus sigma minus identity minus sigma z, like so. And the mapping, the similarity transform that takes us there, better be a negative sign there somewhere. Thank you. All right, so this is the, can't do that. Let's call it T. That's the similarity transform that takes us from the Pauli basis to the transition basis. So I have ST is equal to T S Pauli. And let's just leave it as the inverse. And then Choi came up with a nice decomposition, which I'm not going to show you the linear algebra of, that shows that if I map this matrix to the Choi matrix, and I take the Choi matrix, the eigenvalue decomposition of that, that will directly return the most compact set of operators to describe the physics. Okay? So we'll take this to the Choi matrix, and it's easiest if I show this to you schematically. So if I have ST, and I break them into 2 by 2, S is a 4 by 4 matrix. I break it into 2 by 2 matrices, and then I just have a permutation of that. So S of Choi is that. Okay, and this permutation matrix, Choi has a theorem that says if I take the eigenvalue decomposition of the super operator that is completely positive, I can return a Krauss decomposition. And how many of you took Daniel's course? Gottesman. All right. So you spend some time in Daniel's course, looking at the mapping of the Krauss operators, and you saw that if I take the product of the Krauss operators and its transpose, that that's going to equal the identity matrix. And under that condition, this thing is completely positive. Now, these are, of course, not unitaries. And it's close to the description that we have over here, which says that let's take rho out equal to sum over k of p of k u of k rho in uk inverse. Okay, where this now is a probability. And in either case, the sum of these is the dimension of the Hilbert space, that's all the elements you need. This is a little bit more restrictive than that, but that's OK. And now what we're going to do is rewrite this as the sum of k, the square root of p of k, u of k, rho, square root of p of k, u of k inverse. Okay. And I'll make a correspondence here. Okay. Now what we're going to get out of the Krauss decomposition, out of the Choi matrix, is in this case we will get out a set of probabilities and unitaries. What you'll see in the what you heard about from Daniel was to get out a set of these operators, usually described in this way, as a set of probabilities and operators. And we'll see that description in just a second. OK? So now, I know this is a little bit saying, here's some magic. You take this, reorder it. I take the eigenvalue decomposition of this matrix, and let me just write these down for you. And in this particular case, what we find is 1 minus a probability of the identity matrix and a probability of sigma x. Okay. Now, when I take the eigenvectors of this, maybe I better show you this here so I don't so I define the Krauss, the Choi matrix here. There's these factors of square root of 2 and 1/2 that one needs to include to get the probabilities correct. Here's the eigenvalues of that. I put it in for some particular value. So this is 1 minus the probability, and that's the probability of an action. Here we have a rho version of a Pauli matrix. And you can see the first column would be 0, 1, 0, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1. So that's the identity matrix. And 0, 1, 1, x, 1, 0. So that's sigma x. And so as advertised, there's only 2 operators. The other 2 operators are identically 0. And the other 2 possible operators, and it's the identity in sigma x. Yeah? Okay, so so let me finish up this picture. Here, we went through, said that we had a Gaussian distribution of errors. We calculated from the Gaussian distribution a super operator. We have this very simple super operator. We have these probabilities in terms of an error function. Now, if I left the wedge in there, that would be the sink function. But here, it's an error function. We have two Krauss operators. Now, if I want to describe them as Krauss operators here, I'd better take the square roots of these probabilities, because they're going to appear twice as I sum over the dynamics. Yeah? And so we have two Krauss operators with only one probability. And of course, well, because they have to add up the ones, there's only one free parameter. And that probability, p is equal to f of r. And so let's look at what this means as we map this dynamic. I don't need any of this. What we expect is if I look at these amplitudes as a function of the amount of error, then what we're going to see is that effectively, as we increase the error 0, 1, 0.5, this is the probability of the identity, and this is the probability of sigma x, that they're going to go to 1/2. And that at the point that the error is big enough, what we will see is a random process, that we will not know whether the information was scrambled by some action or not. And these things are typically called jump operators. So they're defining the fundamental physics behind the errors that we're introducing into this process. Okay, so we have a set of jump operators. If you've heard of Lindbladians, it's exactly the same jump operators, but in a Lindblad structure, it's assumed that, the events are happening randomly, so there's a Markov physics, Markov process underlying that. Yeah? Okay, so now let's take and look at a more interesting set of Krauss operators. I'm going to just look at one more thing on the board here. Of course, I don't know if you can really see these boards. We can define these operators. So I define two Krauss operators in terms of the identity. Pauli 0 is the identity. And sigma x, it's perfectly clear that, the sum of the squares of those prefactors is 1. And if I then go and look at the action of that to calculate the super operator and to map out what we expect to see in the neutron interferometer, then we see that that exactly as we showed before, that we have a contrast curve when the error is 0. As we increase the error, the contrast curve vanishes, and we simply get the probability of 1/2. So this is the intensity in the O-beam versus the phase flag versus the error that we introduce. No error, nice contrast curve. This is the O-beam, lots of error, no contrast curve, half the neutrons show up at that beam. We look at the H beam, we see the complement of that, the same dynamics. Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, I'm going to switch to the file that I just sent you. Okay. So this is not a file that you have yet. We're going to go over in a couple seconds some standard Krauss operator maps. And if we think about the physics of any system, for now, let's forget about neutron interferometry. We have any system in SU2. So I have any system in SU2, and I want to describe a generalized dynamic. Then I'm going to introduce some Hamiltonian, because I want an energy in the system, so there's some Hamiltonian that specifies a direction. So it doesn't matter what we use here, I just need a preferred direction so that we have an energy. And any Hamiltonian that I could define there, of course, I could put it along z. So we'll just put it along z to begin with. And the first process that we see is that we have random noise along the energy axis, so-called decoherence. So here we have random noise that acts along z. And here I mean in the operator sense along z. And so we'll have, there's only one noise, so there'll be two Krauss operators, just as we saw before. Call it D because we'll talk about some other Krauss operators. And the as with all noise, we hope that the most likely thing is that there is no noise. And so there'll be some probability that there is no noise, and there's some probability that there's noise along sigma z. And I want to describe this. Yeah. In terms of one parameter. So T2, in this case, is a time constant. And it says, in a Markov case, effectively, what is the correlation time of the noise? We will treat it as just a rate equation. So it's only describing the rate of loss of information due to this random fluctuation along z. This is a rate of loss of coherence. And if I looked at this set of dynamics and I wanted to calculate the superoperator for that, well, it would be easy enough. I'd say that S for decoherence is, again, equal to the trace of some probability. The sum here from 1 to 2, there's only two Krauss operators, of this Krauss operator acting. So K1B, the unitary. So let's define a unitary here. You can come up with them from a Lindblad, and I'll show you that at the end of next week. Okay, but the way you would do it is to say, let's take some random noise. Let's assume that random noise is acting with a Markov process, so there's no memory effects in it. Let's average the dynamics over that, and you can see that if we're averaging over a Markov process, what we should get is an exponential term. And so it'll come out with that integral. Yeah? So it simply says that the probability that we have an error is independent of what happened before. It's just a constant in time, and integrate that.
What are we assuming about the distribution of omega?
This is constant.
Oh.
This noise, which is, I guess, what your question is I can relate this constant to that distribution. And it's going to come as the second moment times the characteristic time. But it's in the Markov process, it'll just be that second moment. I have to think about whether it's one over or not. Let me think about that before I tell you the wrong thing. Okay, so we have U of T, PJ, K, KK, D transpose. Make this nice. Like so, and these are a function of time as well. And there's my super operator, and we can define the dynamic based upon that. Now, in this case, it's really easy, right? Because the Krauss operators commute with the unitary that I'm applying, and so I can combine them at any instant in time. I don't actually have to integrate over a path. Everything is nice. Okay, so that's that piece. That won't be the case if I think about having a depolarizing effect. So now I'm going to have noise along the x direction. And noise along the x direction, of course, is going to have a similar form. I'm going to call it T1 because depolarizing is an energy process. So to answer Chris's question, in this case, I would have to take that noise and look at the spectral density at that frequency. And again, we will do that. But at the moment, I'm just going to parameterize these things. Okay, and now what one finds is that as you apply this, I can't apply it this way. Actually, you have to integrate over time because the unitary and the Krauss operators no longer commute. Okay, if there was a few moments more, I would show you that in some detail. But at the moment, what I'll ask you to do is just calculate this, or you can look in the notes where I do the calculation for you and see that dynamic, okay? And recognize that this depolarizing channel is going to introduce decoherence. I want you to see that in this case, decoherence doesn't introduce a depolarization because the Krauss operators commute with the quantizing Hamiltonian. Here, depolarizing will, in fact, introduce decoherence because the Krauss operators do not commute with the quantizing Hamiltonian. Two more things, and then we'll stop with this picture and come back to it when we talk about spins. Here I had the noise along the x-axis, but this system, it has cylindrical symmetry, so there's nothing special about noise along the x-axis. So I could ask, well, what happens for noise along the y-axis? And of course, it's exactly the same. As this noise, so just take those two prefactors, except that I have to put the action along y. And if the system truly has cylindrical symmetry, so these models are relevant for some systems. You'll see that in the superconducting systems. But if the system really does have cylindrical symmetry, then the noise acts along x and y. And it's very easy to compose those Krauss descriptions because the Krauss descriptions are telling us that this is a random process. And so all I need to do is multiply these together. So I will end up with four terms. There'll be the term where these two probabilities are multiplied together. So I'll have the identity. There'll be a term of the identity multiplying sigma x, sigma y, and of course, the product of sigma x and sigma y is sigma z. And so I'll end up with the full complement of four Krauss operators. And the probabilities of these three are all the same. So I'll end up here with, just call it P for now. And here, 1 minus 3p. And OK, we can rewrite them as this, and that's easy enough to do. Yeah? But you'll see that in the notes. Since we're out of time, I'll stop there. OK, so this shows a set of models that we can borrow from of how noise enters gracefully, if you have nice graceful noise. So Markovian processes about simple geometric elements of space, how that enters in to lead to decoherence in the system. We saw what happens if you have more complicated noise, so noise that enters in without a Markov process. Yeah. And what we'll do tomorrow is we'll go and take a different direction and re-examine the neutron interferometer from the point of a wave packet picture of the neutron in the interferometer. OK? And I know this is too quick for this stuff, but we will come back to it with spins. So you'll see part of that again. Thanks. Yeah, questions? Yeah.